At birth, the self does not exist. What exists is the raw material from which a self can develop. A newborn infant doesn't have a sense of personal identity. There is not awareness of separateness, at least not the way adults experience separateness. The primary human task is evolving into selfhood. It is also the primary human challenge, because success is not guaranteed. At any step of the way, the process can be interrupted, frustrated, blocked, or sidetracked, so that the human individual is fragmented, split, alienated, or stuck at a certain level of mental or emotional immaturity. To a tragic extent, most people are stranded along this path of development. Nonetheless, the central goal of maturing is evolution toward autonomy. This is the essence of the process that is called separation individuation. The foremost task of early infancy is discovering boundaries, discovering where the self ends and the outside world begins. Normal development depends on grasping and assimilating the facts of separateness, particularly from the mother figure. The second and overlapping part of the maturing process is individuation. During this stage, a child acquires basic motor and cognitive skills, along with a first sense of physical and personal identity. This represents the foundations of a child's autonomy, that is, the child's capacity for inner direction, self-regulation, and self-responsibility. Separation and individuation mark the child's birth as a human being. They are necessary for a well-developed self-esteem. Separation and individuation is a process that has meaning at every stage of human development. It manifests itself through the entire span of the life cycle. The process is inseparable from the development and maintenance of healthy self-esteem. Think of separation as an emergence and differentiation from any fundamental form of support, be it mother, family, identification with a particular job, or an outmoded or limiting belief system. Think of individuation as a striving toward wholeness and completion. During the process of individuation, we come closer to meeting our potential, expanding our boundaries to embrace all of our possibilities, as well as those parts that have been denied, disowned, or repressed. On a purely biological level, birth itself is the first instance of the separation and individuation that will later be manifested psychologically. The fetus initially exists as a part of the mother's body. Then, at birth, it separates and comes into the world as a distinct individual entity. Until the fetus leaves the womb, its first support system, it cannot exist as a physically separate being. It must say goodbye to one level of existence before it can say hello to a more advanced level. In much the same way, we say goodbye to the womb of the family when we go out into the world on our own. The task of emergence confronts us continually in the course of our existence. We can see the basic pattern in the child's growth to adulthood, from learning to walk to selecting a career and establishing a home and a life. But we can see the same process at work in the struggle of a woman who is over-identified with her role as mother. When her child is grown, she confronts the challenging question of who she is now that her child doesn't depend on her anymore. When a marriage ends in divorce, or when a life partner of many years dies, a person must encounter the question of his or her identity outside the context of the former relationship. Once again, what is involved is a process of emergence, separation, and individuation. Each stage of development in the life cycle contains its own hazards and its own challenges. The more appropriately we meet our needs at any one stage, the more prepared we are for the next stage. Again, think of the fetus. If its needs are met as nature requires, it is ready for separation and entrance into the world as a human being. If not, it brings the consequences of its unmet needs with it. For example, the child may be frail or unhealthy. A well-nurtured infant is well-prepared for childhood. A child whose needs are well met is well prepared for adolescence. Successful negotiation of the transitions through adolescent years paves the way for the beginning of adulthood, and so on. As self evolves, the major stages of development are like a series of matrix shifts, a series of deaths and births, of goodbyes and hellos. So that the attainments of one stage of development provide the energy and thrusting power for evolution to the next stage. We use these attainments to transcend them. As we've seen, the first matrix shift is birth itself. The next major shift is from mother to the world, occurring at about age 7. A growing knowledge of self and the world prepares the child for the possibility of independent physical survival. By adolescence, if development has proceeded successfully, the individual has become his or her own matrix. The next shift is from concrete thinking to increasingly abstract thinking, with mind itself as the highest matrix in this biological hierarchy. If we think biologically, then we can see that each matrix shift, each stage of development, entails movement toward greater autonomy. Autonomy doesn't mean self-sufficiency in the absolute sense. Autonomy pertains to a human being's capacity for independent survival, independent thinking, independent judgment. It pertains to the extent to which the source of self-approval lies within rather than without. Autonomy consists of living by one's own mind. To live by your own mind doesn't mean that you don't learn from others. It means that you don't attempt to live by unthinking conformity and the suspension of independent critical judgment. You take responsibility for the ideas you accept and the values by which you guide your actions. This characterization of autonomy is still very abstract. You need to grasp some of the essentials of successful self-emergence in a more concrete and specific way. Let's look, therefore, at 4 aspects of individuation that will help us to understand this whole process better: sexual, emotional, cognitive, and moral. In considering the sexual realm, I'd like to offer a brief psychotherapy vignette to illustrate my point. John was a 31-year-old engineer. He had come to therapy because of feelings of anxiety, confusion, and incompetence in relationships with women. He was a virgin. He professed a desire to be married and to have a family of his own, and at the same time he complained that women might as well be members of a different species, utterly incomprehensible to him. After we had gone through his history and developed a rapport, we started on sentence completion work. I would give him a number of sentence stems, and he was to keep repeating each stem, finishing the sentence in any way he wished, until I signaled him to stop. We began with this stem. Mother was always beautiful, remote, walking around the house in a negligee, mysterious, seductive, telling me I was her little man, overwhelming. Next, I gave him the stem. With mother, I felt confused, fascinated, sometimes excited. I loved the smell of her. I wanted to be close. I was special. I was more important than father. Then I went to the stem. Father was always quiet, watching me strangely, scaring me without saying a word, off somewhere, looking at me as if he were just about to say something, but he never did. Next, I gave him the stem. With father, I felt frightened, nervous, watchful.
Sometimes defiant. I wanted us to be closer. I wanted him to help me understand what a man was.
This was enough to suggest that my client was in some sense stuck at the childhood phase of development. In discussing his reaction to what he had been saying, I found it interesting that he seemed surprised and yet unsurprised, as if at one level it was all new and unfamiliar, and yet at another it was already known to some part of his psyche, which of course was precisely the case. We continued with another stem. If Mother thought I was in a happy relationship...
If Mother thought I was in a happy relationship, she'd be jealous. She'd tell me that no one will ever love me as she does. She'd feel abandoned. She'd say, "How can you do this to me?" She'd try to break us up. She'd tell me the woman wasn't good enough. She'd warn me about feminine wiles. She'd want to know what the woman wanted from me.
The scary thing about women is...
The scary thing about women is, I don't know what they want. They're overwhelming. They have needs I don't understand. They give conflicting messages. I'll be swallowed up. I won't know what to do. They'll want more from me than I can give. I'll be dominated.
Women to me are...
Women to me are overwhelming, powerful, insatiable, frightening, exciting, seductive, controlling, too much like Mother.
If it turns out that other women are not my mother...
If it turns out that other women are not my mother, I might be able to fall in love. I could grow up. I wouldn't have to be so frightened of being controlled. I might be able to let go of Mother.
If Mother had seen that I was only a little boy...
If Mother had seen that I was only a little boy, maybe she would have loved me as a little boy. Maybe I could have loved her as a mother. Maybe she wouldn't have looked to me for what she didn't get from Father. Maybe I wouldn't be so afraid of women. Maybe I wouldn't feel like I'm still 4 years old. Maybe I wouldn't put Mother's face on every woman I meet.
In subsequent therapy sessions, he engaged in imaginary dialogue with his mother and father, in which he played all the roles. The purpose was to allow him to further own, experience, and integrate feelings and reactions from long ago that were obstructing his development to normal adulthood. John provides a living illustration of the failure of adequate separation and individuation as it affects sexual development. His story shows a failure to successfully negotiate a stage of childhood development which obstructed his path toward adult sexuality. Sexuality was arrested at the level of pre-autonomy. A necessary process of separation and individuation had failed to take place. Consider some of the differences between emotionally mature and immature people in the conduct of their relationships. Emotionally mature people understand that others don't exist just to satisfy their needs. With maturity, you accept the fact that no matter how much love and caring exists between two people, each of us is ultimately responsible for our happiness and self-esteem. An autonomous individual doesn't experience his or her self-esteem as continually in question or in jeopardy. The source of approval lies within the self. It's not at the mercy of every encounter with another person. One of the characteristics of the emotionally mature is that they have grown beyond the need to prove to anyone that they are a good boy or a good girl, or, for that matter, a defiantly bad boy or bad girl. Their relationship to their spouse or romantic partner is not that of a daughter or a son. They may experience moments when they would like their partner to function as mother or father. That's normal. That's different. That's not what we're talking about. Experienced occasionally, such moments can be quite natural, but they do not form the essence of a relationship. In the best of relationships, there are occasional frictions and unavoidable hurts, true enough. The tendency of immature people is to make such minor incidents into major evidence of rejection. Emotionally mature men and women have a greater capacity to see the normal frictions of everyday life realistically. Even if they're hurt occasionally, they tend not to make such moments into catastrophes. These men and women respect their partner's occasional needs to be alone, to be preoccupied, to think about vital matters other than the relationship. Mature people also give this freedom to themselves. Men and women who have reached an adult level of individuation and maturity have assimilated and integrated the ultimate fact of human aloneness, of which I spoke earlier. They understand that it is the fact of aloneness that gives love its unique intensity. With emotionally immature men and women, the story is entirely different. Many such people face life with an attitude that, when I was 5 years old, important needs of mine were not met, and until they are, I'm not moving on to 6. On a basic level, these people are very passive, even though on more superficial levels they may appear active and even aggressive. They are waiting to be rescued, waiting to be told they are good boys or good girls, waiting to be validated or confirmed by some outside source. They didn't discover their possibilities for strength and self-support in the normal course of their development through childhood and adolescent years. Now they may have organized their lives around their sense of deficiency, trying either to please, to be taken care of, or alternately, to control and dominate, to manipulate and coerce the satisfaction of their needs and wants. They don't trust the authenticity of anyone's professed love or caring. They have no confidence that what they are, without their facades and manipulations, is enough. Whether they seek completion and fulfillment through domination or through submission, controlling or being controlled, ordering or obeying, there is always the fundamental sense of emptiness, a void in the center of their being. Symbiotic dependency is not a foundation for powerful, passionate love between a man and a woman. When such children marry and fantasy collapses to reality, disillusionment and mutual blame are commonly the result. Passionate love, on the other hand, ignites in a context of separation and individuation. Saying it more simply, passionate love flowers in a context of independence. We turn now to the cognitive realm. Maturity is the state of being fully grown or developed. Cognitive or intellectual maturity is successful development of a human consciousness. Let's break down what this means. A child's world is only the immediate now. The ability to think, plan, or act on a long-range basis is not yet developed. The future is largely unreal. At this stage, there is a high level of dependency, even though great differences are already observable among children with regard to independence and self-assertiveness. As the child grows, the intellectual field widens. The child learns language, begins to grasp abstractions, begins to generalize, learns to look for principles, and acquires the ability to project a more and more distant future. The child develops a growing capacity for objectivity, an ability to see people, situations, and facts apart from the individual's own desires, fears, and needs. This capacity for objectivity is an essential of independence and autonomy. Intellectual maturity is the ability to think in principles, and it is not entirely separable from moral and emotional development. There are people who are brilliant at forming concepts in higher mathematics or the stock market who become helplessly blind to abstractions when their focus is on personal problems with their spouses, children, friends, or associates at work. An ultimate form of maturity is the ability to think in principles about oneself. The ability to have the same perspective on your own behavior as you would have on someone else's is rare, and yet that is one of the meanings of well-realized maturity. In the absence of this level of maturity, there is always some dependency, no matter how responsible the person may be in other aspects of his or her life. It is our spouses, our children, our friend, or our work associates who are left to absorb the consequences of our underdeveloped consciousness. Maturity entails the ability to perceive the fairness or unfairness, the right or wrong, the justice or injustice of our own behavior and the behavior of others with equal clarity. This is one of the meanings of objectivity. It is also a form of autonomy. It is a triumph of selfhood, a triumph of individuation. This leads us directly to the fourth aspect of self-development that I want us to think about, the progression toward moral autonomy. While intellectual development and moral development certainly are tied together, a high level of one doesn't guarantee a high level of the other. Moral development is a separate track in an individual's life. People have the need to generate moral choices and decisions. It's intrinsic to the developmental process, and it's easy to see why this is so. Reality continually confronts us with a wide variety of alternatives. We require a code of values to guide our actions. Moral values aren't an arbitrary invention of society and religion. They are biological. They are requirements of survival and effective functioning. Our need of a moral code is ultimately biological. It relates to our survival. A newborn infant has no awareness of morality, of course. Ethical judgment slowly evolves and goes through various stages in the course of a person's growth. There is fairly strong agreement among psychologists specializing in the process of development that the highest level one can arrive at in this area is a condition of moral autonomy. At this level, a person behaves in ways he or she judges to be moral, not because of fear of punishment, not because of fear of social disapproval, and not because of blind conformist rule following, but rather because of a real, first-hand assessment of the right and wrong of given situations. Autonomy in the field of ethics represents a very advanced level in the maturing process and, sad to say, is not widely attained. Often when people are wrestling with moral dilemmas, they are unaware of the different voices debating within them. The voice of mother pointing to one path, the voice of father to another, the voice of a teacher, spiritual guru, or psychotherapist to a third. Then, underneath all of this, there is often the faint, faint, ever so faint voice of the individual involved, weakly struggling to have a say in the decision-making process. One of the characteristics of a high level of autonomy is respect for inner signals, the voice of the authentic self, which often contradicts the teachings of conventional morality. This self might tell one to be compassionate when conventional morality says to be stern, or to be angry when conventional morality says to be humble, or to be proud when conventional morality says to be self-disparaging, or to be challenging when conventional morality says to be compliant. It's difficult to escape the conclusion that conformity to authority and imitative rule following are more the norm than the exception among most adults. If you think this judgment is too severe, let's shift our perspective from the intimately personal to the world at large. every 20 seconds on this planet, one human being kills another human being. You heard me, but I'm going to say it again. Every 20 seconds on this planet, one human being kills another human being. Viewed globally, the overwhelming majority of these killings were not committed for personal gain. They don't fall into the category of individual crime. Most of the people who did the killing were obeying authority, fighting for a cause, submerging self and personal judgment in the service of something allegedly greater than themselves, more important than their private egos or individual consciences. I'd like to recall here the famous experiment conducted at Yale University by Dr. Stanley Milgram and reported in his book Obedience to Authority. In a brilliantly executed study, Milgram put together a group of test subjects from the general population. These people were led to believe that they were serving the goals of science by giving increasingly severe and painful electric shocks to other volunteer subjects who answered certain questions incorrectly. They were told that they were taking part in a study of the effects of punishment on learning. The second group of subjects, the ones who were getting the shocks, were in fact play-acting. They did not receive any shocks at all, yet they were instructed to respond with screams and cries of pain as though they were. The people giving the shocks did not know that they were the ones actually being tested to see how willing they'd be to surrender moral autonomy to the voice of authority. Before conducting the experiment, Milgram invited a group of psychiatrists to speculate about the outcome. The 39 psychiatrists shared the view that most people would not go beyond 150 volts, which would be the first time the victims in quote, could ask to be released. They expected, the psychiatrists did, that only 4% would reach 300 volts. And that only about 1 in 1,000 would administer the highest shock on the board. In fact, under the instructions of the presiding scientist and authority figure, ignoring the screams and cries of the apparent victims, more than 60% of the Yale subjects kept pressing the dummy buttons up to the limit of 450 volts. Even though this voltage was clearly marked danger, severe shock. This experiment has been repeated in a number of universities throughout the world with essentially the same results. In other countries, the percentage of people who gave the upper limit of voltage was generally higher than at Yale. Most people are astonished when they learn the results of this experiment. They can't understand how such cruelty is possible among civilized human beings, especially fellow Americans. The experiment is well known. I submit that its meaning is not. One of the theses of this program is that most of us have been trained to push those buttons since the day we were born. This training is inherent in our method of child rearing and education. We deal here with the whole process by which a new human being is prepared for life in society, a process that throws countless obstacles in the path of developing healthy moral autonomy. We are taught very early to respect external signals above internal signals, to respect the voice of others above the voice of self. A good child is one who minds his or her elders. A good child is one who behaves. We are taught to identify virtue with compliance with the wants and expectations of others. We are taught conformity as the ultimate civic good. We are taught obedience as the price of love and acceptance. We are taught that the self is evil or unimportant or petty or something to be tamed and suppressed, and that to honor the self is to alienate the individual from family or community or society or God or the universe or the whole. Very few forces within our culture actively encourage intellectual or moral autonomy. The more common goal of parents and teachers is social adaptation. Generally, schools are places where children learn not to think, but to follow the rules. I vividly remember my own experiences in grade school and high school. I quickly learned the two most important values in that world, the ability to remain silent and motionless for long periods of time, and the ability to march with my fellow students in a neat row from one classroom to another. In other words, don't cause the teacher trouble. School was not a place to learn independent thinking or to be self-assertive. It was a place to learn how to fit into some nameless system created by some nameless others and called the world or society or the way life is. And the way life is was not to be questioned. Many brilliant minds have commented on their dismal experiences in school, their boredom, their lack of intellectual stimulation and nourishment. What makes this state of affairs particularly unfortunate is that schools represent priceless opportunities to undo or at least counteract the child's negative experiences at home. Teachers have a unique opportunity to offer the child an alternative view of self and the world, to give a child the experience of having his or her feelings, dignity, and mind respected, and to provide a powerfully healing transition to adolescence and adulthood. This happens sometimes, but when it does, it is the exception rather than the norm. I'm not saying that children should have unrestricted freedom. Children need limits. They need guidelines. They need them for their security, and they need them for their survival. Adults do have greater knowledge than children. The question is, how is this knowledge best transmitted? One can teach with respect or with intimidation. One can speak to a child's intelligence or to his or her fear of punishment. One can offer a child reasonable choices, or one can lay down the law, as is done in the army. One can accept a child's mistakes as a natural part of growing, or one can react with ridicule or harsh punishment. One of the most important ways teachers and parents can aid the growth of healthy self-esteem in children is by accepting the process of making mistakes as natural and normal. When a person of any age acquires a rational perspective on mistakes, then self-esteem is nourished and fostered, and fewer mistakes are made because the person's consciousness is not controlled by fear. No one who is terrified of making mistakes is going to attain moral autonomy. The process of successful growth to psychological maturity, to intellectual and moral autonomy, depends on a person's accepting intellectual responsibility for his or her own existence. As a person grows to adulthood, reality presents increasingly more complex challenges in thought, knowledge, judgment, and decision-making. Apart from the environmental factors we have already discussed, there are at least four factors that can motivate a person to abandon the responsibility of independence and cognitive self-reliance. They are the following. 1. Thinking does require mental work. It takes an effort. 2. A policy of responsibility toward facts and truth forbids one the possibility of indulging irrational or opposing desires or emotions. 3. If a person makes an error at any step of the thinking process and acts on that error, he or she may suffer pain, defeat, or destruction. Thinking is not infallible. 4. Independent thinking often brings a person into conflict with the opinions and judgments of others and may provoke disapproval or animosity. to assume responsibility for choosing our values, principles, and goals, relying solely upon our own reason and understanding, is to practice the ultimate form of intellectual independence, the one most difficult for the overwhelming majority of people and for which their upbringing has least prepared them. To think for oneself is to face the fact of one's own being and so to confront the possibility, perhaps the terror, of non-being. To think, to judge, to choose our values is to be individuated, to create a distinct personal identity. To affirm that I exist in this way is to open myself to the realization that I am finite, that my life is limited, that I am mortal, that one day I will die. The rebellion against the inevitability of death results in a rebellion against the challenges and opportunities of life. If I refuse to live fully, I may tell myself, I cannot die. So, fear of autonomy entails fear of responsibility, entails fear of aloneness, entails fear of death. That which does not exist cannot die. This issue is of such profound importance that I will return to it after we have explored further and from other perspectives the nature and challenges of the individuation process.